Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Monday, January 15th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. It's been 50 years since Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. began a major push for economic justice in our country and joined it to the civil rights movement already underway. And on this national celebration of Dr. King's birthday, we look back to 1968 and the Poor People's Campaign, a call for underprivileged people across the country to rise up to demand better jobs, better wages, education, and more. King talked about the poor in America, in Vietnam, and around the world at a church in Memphis, Tennessee on April 3rd, the night before he was murdered.
There's something getting done and done in a hurry to bring the colored peoples of the world out of their long years of poverty, their long years of hurt and neglect. The whole world is doomed.
King also spoke that night in support of the sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee, on strike in protest of low wages and poor working conditions.
The issue is injustice. The issue is the refusal of Memphis to be fair and honest in its dealings with its public servants who happen to be sanitation workers.
50 years later now, there's an effort underway to revive Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign. Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris is co-director of the Cairo Center and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival.
What's very important to us is that this Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, is not a commemoration. We are not trying to just 50 years later say there was really important work that happened, we should honor that. We think that the only way to honor that work, the only way to look back into history and learn from it, is to pick up work that was unfinished and take it to its fruitful conclusion. And so today, 50 years later, the only solution we have to the problems that are facing us now is to band together and to say that enough is enough, and that people of goodwill and conscience, impacted folks, people who believe that the arc of the moral universe is just, need to say we need to put the priorities of people around healthcare, around living wages, around an end to systemic racism. That's what thousands of people across this country are uniting to do.
So give me a sense then of what this is going to look like in the spring on the streets and on people's TV screens and in their newspapers. You've pledged protests and demonstrations, direct action, you mentioned it, across the country in dozens of cities. What will that look like?
So what's being planned is that starting on May 13th, which is Mother's Day, and going for 40 days until June 21st, in state houses across the country, people of all walks of life will come together for grassroots organizing, door-to-door organizing, direct action, voter registration. And there'll be kind of themes of each week. There'll be 6 weeks of this kind of season of moral direct action, including people are signing up to say that they're prepared to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience. There will be mass meetings and cultural events. There will be public education, you know, forums. There will be direct actions and marches, and there will be opportunities for folks to be doing nonviolent civil disobedience at state capitals across the country. And then it will all kind of culminate on June 23rd, when folks will get their kind of marching orders to go back and keep on building in their communities with the moral agenda that has already been developed, to be able to build longstanding, deeply rooted moral movements in their states, made up of people who are impacted materially as well as impacted kind of spiritually around these issues. People are ready to make their voices heard.
And Dr. Theo Harris, let's say we have you back in 5 years and we replay part of this discussion between you and me here today. How are we going to know that you were a success? What's going to look like success for you when you look back on this day when you were planning this direct action to know if it worked out or not?
We see two kinds of outcomes, two kinds of success. One is the policies that we're going to be able to get passed. And we're going to work on policies coming out of grassroots communities that need to be passed, you know, around healthcare, around living wages, around guaranteed income, around safe water, around voter suppression and voting rights, all of those issues. And so part of the way that we'll gauge the success is the policies that we're able to enact. But it's also the people that have been woken up who have said, this is our country and we want to make it good for everybody. And that is the kind of success that when you look at social change efforts in history, people think it's a little bit harder to measure that, but you can see it because of the hundreds and thousands of people who have said that, you know, everyone's survival and thriving in this society is what matters to me. You know, already the success has started because already people, in a time when things look pretty bleak, in a time when there's mean-spiritedness everywhere, there are people who, against all odds, have come together to say, we can make this country something that it has not yet been, but it can be.
Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Doctor, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
We turn now to Sean King, columnist at The Intercept and a social justice activist. Sean, welcome.
Good to be on here with you, man.
And it's good to have you, Sean. It always is. Well, you heard Liz Theo Harris there talking about practical success,
right,
in this age of rebuilding a social justice movement in the name of Dr. Martin Luther King. What did you think about what she had to say and showing results? You know, not the best speeches, not the best marches, but the best policies.
Yeah, I thought it was spot on. I mean, I resonated with every word of it. I mean, it resonates with a lot of us because I still believe speeches and marches are important, but we're at a point in this new movement, this new civil rights movement, where we're saying, how do we properly organize people in a way that resonates, in a way that sticks, and how do we mobilize these people that we've organized in a way that makes substantive policy changes happen? And we're starting to see that city by city, town by town, state by state. And I think we're beginning to see, particularly in the age of Donald Trump, that we have to act locally for the changes that we want to see. And so I resonate with this Poor People's Campaign and with their ideals.
You know, last week at the White House, Sean, was a pretty remarkable string of events.
Yeah.
The president led a commemoration of Dr. King, had some folks in the White House for the photo op and the brief speeches. Those are pretty normal. It was 24 hours before where the president's words in that meeting about immigration were broadcast all over the world. We all know what the key word was.
Yeah.
And I think we know what the key attitude was too, which I said on this air clearly was racist. It was a remarkable 24 hours and it's been a remarkable week since.
Yeah, I'm still so disgusted by it. And it's a crazy time. It's a disgusting time to hear these things come out of the mouth of the president. I spoke to so many friends of mine who are immigrants from those nations that he offended, and they were hurt by it. It wasn't just like, oh, that's gross. It's hurtful to hear the president of the United States describe your country of origin, your homeland, in that way. And I think he's continued. Like, there are moments where I think it can get no worse. I think we've hit some degree of rock bottom, and Donald Trump says something or does something to show me, no, we can go lower than this. It can get uglier than this. And it's disturbing. I think this is something that's going to stick with many of us.
What's your outlook right now, Sean? Day to day, week to week, it can get tough, I think, and I won't speak for you. But seeing these developments week for week going lower toward rock bottom, okay, now I've hit rock bottom, what's going to happen next Tuesday? You're stuck in the moment instead of in the long fight.
Yeah, you know, we can't get stuck in that moment. And I think Donald Trump and the things he says and does really does disturb many of us. But I'm not allowing the words that come out of his mouth or the tweets that he issues to determine my mood or my outlook or my hope for what's ahead. I'm actually hopeful, and I say that with no hyperbole. I look and see the quality of our organizing. I feel like 2018, and I say this not just to be optimistic, I really believe it. I think 2018 is going to be a year of a lot of substantial victories, political victories, elections, serious reforms that get passed. And I feel hopeful about that because I know the groups of people that are putting in the work to organize, and there's an energy of people who want to fight back and want to see the fruits of their labor. And so 2018 will still be tough, and we will continue to have hard moments where we wonder, have we gone back in time and why does it feel so ugly? But I think just like in other times in the 60s, you know, they had so much ugliness that they experienced, but they won some really hard-fought victories as well, and I think we'll experience that.
Sean, before I let you go, and I can hear the optimism in your voice, look on the national scene for me for 1 second, because for all of the optimism that you and your allies have in the fights that you're fighting, when you look all the way across the country, it seems like it's going to be slow.
Well, some reforms will be slow and will be hard to enact, but you know, that's why we say on some of these fights we have to go local. Like, for instance, the state of Georgia, which is a Republican state, may not pass meaningful reforms on the decriminalization and legalization of marijuana, but Atlanta can. And so even though 63 million people voted for Donald Trump, and even though he has this base of 35% base that seems that they will never leave him no matter what he says or does, we do see a rising tide of people who are incredibly frustrated with him. I think you're going to see an increasing number of people who are resentful and regretful that they voted for him. And I think there's evidence of that. I still believe there are some things that we can find some bipartisan support for. The state of North Carolina recently became the last state, the 50th state right after New York, to pass raise the age legislation so that children are not prosecuted for petty misdemeanors. And it was a bipartisan effort. Republicans and Democrats came together. It was a nearly unanimous vote to do it. And actually, they came together better in North Carolina on this than we did here in New York. And so there are opportunities for people to come together. And when we see those, we have to hold on to them tightly.
Sean King, it's always great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, man.
Sean King is a columnist at The Intercept. Shoaib Ahmed arrived at the Texas border in the spring of 2016. He's 24 years old. He was traveling from Bangladesh, where he says he fled because of fear of political persecution. Ahmed made his way through Bolivia and to the United States border, and there he asked for asylum. And ever since, he's been detained in Lumpkin, Georgia, at the Stewart Detention Facility, run by a private corporation on behalf of ICE, called Core Civic. Now, Ahmed says that in November, he was put into solitary confinement for 10 days because a guard overheard him say that he wouldn't work in the facility's kitchen the following day. Ahmed says he was punished for refusing to do what's supposed to be voluntary work. His story is just one of a growing number from across the country, though. Detainees, potentially thousands of them, alleging that they've been exploited with meager wages while private companies profit. Some of them have sued. Spencer Woodman is a reporter for the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and he wrote about the cases for The Intercept.
ICE detainees at privately run facilities across the country say that they were forced to work. ICE says its work program is voluntary, and legally it does need to be voluntary. I mean, the 13th Amendment outlaws slavery and involuntary servitude, and there is a carve out there for people in prison who have been convicted of crimes and are being punished. But that's a different story. I mean, that exemption does not apply to ICE detainees who are detained civilly simply because they've committed civil infraction of being in the country without papers.
And just to make sure that the details are clear, if this is voluntary labor under the law, it doesn't sound so voluntary if, as Mr. Ahmed says anyway, you can land in solitary for refusing to do it.
That's right. And in Mr. Ahmed's case, there have been at this one detention center, which is called the Stewart Detention Center in rural Georgia. It's run by, of course, CoreCivic, which is formerly known as Corrections Corporation of America. And for the past several years, there have been kind of successive allegations by detainees that they were forced to work under the threat of solitary confinement. In October, I wrote a story about the same facility where ICE's own records state that they placed a detainee in disciplinary solitary confinement for 30 days for, quote, encouraging others to participate in a work stoppage.
Spencer, it's a little confusing because I'm not clear at all on what rights Mr. Ahmed and people like him have while being detained in immigration facilities. They're not American citizens, obviously. But does he have an Eighth Amendment protection against cruel and unusual punishment? Would that apply here?
I'm not sure the Eighth Amendment would apply because he is not being punished. What's certain is that he cannot be forced to work. Another question in these lawsuits that have been filed in California, Colorado, and Washington State against ICE's private detention contractors is the contention that they're being illegally paid below minimum wage. Again, in a prison setting where somebody's being punished for a crime, that's a different story. The courts and the legislature have found that that's legal. It's much murkier in a civil detention setting. Interestingly, I mean, the GEO Group, which is one of CoreCivic's major competitors, it's another very large publicly traded private prison firm, has, in responding to one of these suits in Colorado, said very bluntly that its business model relies on this kind of dirt cheap detainee labor. It said that, you know, it, quote, would have a catastrophic impact on GEO Group's ability to fulfill government contracts if it had to pay its detainees minimum wage.
Now, GEO Group and CoreCivic push back on the whole idea of solitary confinement, or at least the term. What do they say?
Right. So, I mean, every time I write one of these stories, I get into this kind of argument with both ICE and CoreCivic, where, you know, there has been an effort to rebrand solitary confinement. They prefer the kind of less harsh terminology of restrictive housing or segregation. I mean, it's always interesting to kind of get into these little disputes over terminology and then talk to the detainees. In Mr. Ahmed's case, you know, he described the highly restrictive and isolating conditions of solitary confinement. His cell was locked, he said, for approximately 23 hours a day. When it was locked, he said he couldn't talk and have anyone hear him. The only chance he had was to shout out, to raise his voice. And he said this was an infraction that would cause him to be punished again and placed into solitary confinement or have his stay in solitary confinement prolonged. And, you know, he at one point said that he, fearing his psychological well-being, wanted to shout out and say, please bring me out, please let me speak with someone, please bring me to some open site. So the private prison contractors that I speak with urge me not to use the term solitary confinement and its harsh connotations that it brings with it. The detainees that I and other reporters have spoken with describe a form of isolating and restrictive housing that would meet what the public widely understands as solitary confinement.
Spencer Woodman, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Spencer Woodman is a reporter for the Pulitzer Prize-winning International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. At about 8:10, on Saturday morning, as residents and tourists across Hawaii were rolling out of bed or sitting down to a weekend breakfast, going on their runs, all of a sudden, cell phones lit up with notifications. The screen on those cell phones read, "Ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill." Well, soon, radios and televisions interrupted programming.
The U.S. Pacific Command has detected a missile threat to Hawaii. A missile may impact on land or sea within minutes. This is not a drill.
It was the scariest 45 minutes of my life yesterday.
That's Michelle Gerdstein there, a Takeaway listener in Kaneahe, Oahu.
Nowhere to run or hide. Called my son in Austin to tell him how much I loved him and was planning on staying on the phone until the end.
For many people across Hawaii, panic. For others, they didn't take the warnings nearly as seriously or, in some cases, didn't hear them at all.
Everybody's got panic, you know. And then the first thing I said, you know, did you hear from Pearl Harbor?
When I got the alert, we were thinking like people just playing around. But some of the customers were so panicked. Yeah. Then that's the time I started to believing in it. So I called my son and called my husband and then called my boss. And she was just telling me to just calm down and pray.
Well, actually, I heard it. I went downstairs to smoke cigarette, drink my coffee. And I seen everybody just beep, 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 just running around. And I just started laughing. Why? No sirens went off. Why panic?
Voices there of residents across Hawaii speaking with Kuʻuvehi Hiriashi from Hawaii Public Radio. Well, within about 10 minutes, state officials took to social media to reassure the public that it was all just a false alarm. But it took about 38 minutes for Hawaii Emergency Management formally to revoke the alert.
So the account we've been given of Saturday morning at first was that this was an error caused by an errant employee during a shift change at the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency.
That's Ankit Panda, senior editor of The Diplomat and an international affairs analyst focusing on the Asia Pacific. He says this type of error is the result of a state scrambling to reinstate systems that haven't been in place since the Cold War.
Basically, an employee clicked a button that they weren't supposed to click. That's what we were told initially. Upon further investigation, it appeared that this was maybe a case of simply bad government software design. It emerged that two alert buttons, one saying test missile alert and one saying missile alert, appeared next to each other on a menu. And the employee, in a rush, instead of clicking test missile alert, accidentally chose missile alert. And apparently there weren't any safeguards or any requirement to confirm that this is what they really wanted to do before the alert went out to hundreds of thousands of people and ruined their Saturday morning.
What happened today was totally unacceptable, and many in our community was deeply affected by this, and I'm sorry for that pain and confusion that anyone might have experienced.
That's Hawaii Governor David Y. Ige trying to calm a frazzled and worried population. Hawaii has been preparing for a possible attack since tensions began to rise between the United States and North Korea. The state's been testing monthly air raid drills, but this alert felt all too real for a lot of people. Hawaii State Representative Matthew Lopresti gave a grim account of Saturday's events on CNN.
I live in an area where if they hit what they were aiming at, we're in the hot zone for radioactive fallout. So we took shelter immediately in the most inner room of our home. I was sitting in the bathtub with my children saying our prayers.
It would only take about 30 minutes, possibly even less, for a real missile to reach Hawaii from North Korea. And if a true alert were sent out, residents would have as little as 12 minutes to prepare themselves. So what went wrong, and what does it tell us about how prepared or unprepared we are for a real catastrophe? We're going to answer that question next with Ankit Panda from The Diplomat. Ankit says a false alarm like this isn't unprecedented, and it could have been a lot worse.
I mean, I think the worst possible scenario, but one that we knew pretty quickly wasn't the case, would be some sort of sensor malfunction. And this is the kind of stuff that, you know, was the stuff of nightmares in the Cold War. For example, in 1979, then National Security Advisor to President Carter, speaking of Brzezinski, was woken up at 3 a.m. in the morning by an aide, told that hundreds of Soviet missiles were incoming, and he had to make a decision right then. So he actually instructed the U.S. bomber force to begin preparing for an attack before he double-checked his own instincts, asked the aide to double-check again, was told that it was simply a misfiring exercise tape, called off the bombers, and went back to bed. That's just one example of many. We have an example on the Soviet side with Stanislav Petrov, who just passed away last year, but he was in a similar situation where Soviet sensors detected incoming American missiles and he decided not to escalate it to a higher level of decision making, possibly preventing an all-out nuclear exchange. Nothing like that happened in Hawaii on Saturday, and we're very fortunate for that. The U.S. does have a range of ground, air, space, and sea-based sensors that detect missiles before they can get anywhere close to the U.S. homeland, allowing the United States to retaliate. We knew that wasn't the case on Saturday because Pacific Command, Strategic Command, NORAD, none of them corroborated the alert that went out from the Hawaii government. But I think that is, you know, a reminder. You know, when we think about these Cold War near misses, we think about something like the software error that caused Saturday's incident. It's a reminder that at the end of the day, our decisions about nuclear weapons are entirely governed by man-made systems, man-made sensors, and they're going to be prone to error.
Talk a little bit more about the military role here. You said that all of the relevant military divisions didn't corroborate what was just basically a civil defense warning gone awry. That seems to have helped a lot. But what if this mistake had been elevated to Washington?
Yeah, so that would have required some degree of involvement by Strategic Command, NORAD, for at least the president to get notified. And during this entire episode playing out, President Trump happened to be on the golf course. So yeah, the military would have to be involved at the highest levels to alert the president of an incoming attack. And then, just given the way the system's set up, if the president decided to issue a valid order to retaliate against any adversary, right, even if the adversary was unknown, the president could decide to issue a valid retaliatory order. The entire American nuclear command and control system is designed in a way that would ensure that that order is carried out.
So is this just a Hawaii problem? How many other states have warning systems like this? Lots of places have warning systems for natural disasters and things like that. Could this happen in other places?
So yes and no. I mean, Hawaii is a bit of a special case in that since late 2017, they've been testing their Cold War era emergency alert systems. This includes air raid sirens. This includes emergency notifications, radio broadcasts, TV broadcasts to alert of an incoming ballistic missile threat. North Korea explicitly has said that Pearl Harbor would be a target that they look to strike in a potential future war. They've demonstrated missile capabilities that would allow them to do that. So I think the Hawaii government is taking this very seriously. During the Cold War, obviously, the entire United States was covered in these kinds of early warning networks that have since been turned off. The Civil Defense Project isn't quite what it used to be on the U.S. homeland. The cell phone aspect of this all, the social media aspect of this all, is very real. And emergency alerts are obviously ubiquitous. You know, we receive them in big cities these days. We receive Amber Alerts. It is a tempting target for anybody looking to sow mass panic to take control of government emergency alert systems, to send out false alerts to large groups of people, causing them to panic in a way that's very difficult to reverse once it's in motion. So Hawaii is a bit of a special case at the moment, but it's not unimaginable that something like this could happen in the future with as a result of direct malice instead of incompetence.
Sure. You know, Ankit, the culture of duck and cover from the Cold War is gone. But so is the social engineering aspect of it, the command and control that governments had to direct citizens' behavior and their attitudes at times like this. We all access this information by ourselves.
Absolutely, we do. And I think with the North Korean threat coming back, a lot of Americans are starting to feel vulnerable to nuclear weapons in a way that they haven't in decades now. And we're at a very dangerous time.
Ankit Panda, senior editor at The Diplomat, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
More of our ongoing coverage now of the opioid crisis in America. There's no single solution to the opioid crisis, so today we take you to a corner of New York City that represents one model of tackling it. And it's not new. It's called harm reduction. It's an approach that puts aside punishment and instead tries to reduce the consequences of drug use. Takeaway producer Alexandra Boti took us to Washington Heights in Manhattan for the story.
Yeah. You all right?
Yeah.
All right, you got a minute. Start cleaning up, please.
That is Lisa. I'm standing with her in the Washington Heights Corner Project in Manhattan, where she has a really important job. Every 3 minutes, she knocks on the bathroom door to make sure that the person inside is not overdosing on a drug like heroin.
Usually we have an instant calm, but right now we're just knocking because of how so many overdoses, so we want to be more cautious.
If Lisa gets no response, she and her colleagues are ready to go in and administer the drug naloxone, or Narcan, to reverse the overdose and save the person's life. This setup is part of the harm reduction approach to drug addiction and policy.
Harm reduction is a health and human rights-based approach seeking to implement services and policies and programs that reduce the negative health and social consequences related to drugs and drug use.
Rick Lyons is the executive director of Harm Reduction International, an NGO based in London.
It's obviously about providing services for people who use drugs, but it's really about providing safer and healthier communities for everyone.
It's a frigid day at the Washington Heights Corner Project. The syringe exchange and harm reduction program is located off a busy corner of this Upper Manhattan neighborhood. I climb some steep stairs to their second floor space, where they have cubicles and offices right next to their drop-in center. That's where people struggling with drug addiction can find services like clean needles, a bathroom, or just a cup of coffee and a warm place to sit. Mark Townsend gives me a tour. He's the Syringe Access Program Director here and Director of New York Harm Reduction Educators.
So we're in the drop-in center, and this is where people can drop in. They can get out of the cold, they can get off the street for a bit, get a cup of tea. This is also where we distribute clean syringes and equipment. It's where we try and encourage people to get tested for HIV and AIDS and hepatitis C so we can treat them and eradicate that disease in New York State. Mm-hmm. And we also have bathrooms here, showers and washing machines for people to do their washing.
Many of the people who come to use the services here are homeless. Almost all struggle with drug addiction.
We give people a card, and by carrying that card, that means if they're stopped by the police, the police understand that they're registered in a program and the syringes that they have to keep themselves safe and to make sure that diseases don't spread through the rest of the population, they're allowed to have them and they don't hassle them.
350 people come through the program's drop-in center every week, but the Corner Project staff also goes out into the community, disposing of discarded syringes, giving out clean ones, passing out Narcan kits, and explaining how to use them to stop an overdose.
So say in the last 2 or 3 weeks, we've maybe had 10 overdose incidents. That's a big increase. One day there were four. There was one at the Payless, there was one outside, there was one in our bathroom, there was one in a park.
Back inside the drop-in center, Lisa, or another staff member, monitors the bathroom all day, knocking every 3 minutes. Registered program participants can sign up for 15-minute slots to use the bathroom however they want. Sometimes the waiting list is several hours long. Now, this is not a so-called safe injection site. Those are legally sanctioned places where people addicted to heroin can safely inject, usually with a medical professional nearby. Facilities like that exist in Canada and parts of Europe. There are around 90 in the world. Here's Rick Lyons again.
These are not places that are set up for casual drug users to access. These are facilities that are specifically for people who are otherwise injecting in incredibly vulnerable and risky scenarios. People who are homeless, people who are underhoused, people who are injecting in public parks and in alleyways. These are not people for whom the availability of a safe injecting space means the difference between injecting and not injecting. What it does mean is often the difference between living and dying.
But safe injection sites, like the kind Rick describes, are not legal here in the United States. And that's probably how it should be, says David Murray.
I think it's the wrong path at this point.
Murray was chief scientist and associate deputy director in the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
There's a little bit of an illusion here. There is no safe heroin injection. We might change the circumstance in which exposure to dirty needles or even an overdose that can be reversed, that changes the immediate moment, but it doesn't change the trajectory of the addict, which is towards greater and greater risk of death.
So the Corner Project's bathroom is in murky legal territory. It is not officially sanctioning drug injection in its bathroom, but will come to your aid if you overdose there. Other programs around the country find themselves in a similar position, and some cities are looking to come out of the shadows. In Philadelphia, Seattle, San Francisco, and Denver, there are efforts to put in place legally sanctioned sites in the face of this wave of deaths from opioid overdoses. Here in Washington Heights, I get a look at what it actually takes to keep someone alive.
This kit contains everything you'll need to reverse an overdose.
That's Jesse Reed, Community Engagement Coordinator at the Corner Project. He trains staff as well as members of the community on how to administer Narcan.
It has a nasal Narcan spray, which is something that just goes, oh, I can use the dummy here. It goes right up the nostril, and you just, it's pretty easy to administer. This is probably the most popular form of Narcan that we give to people to use, just because it's so easy to administer. And here you can see there's 4 milligrams of Narcan, which is enough to take a bear out of an overdose. But there have been times where we've had to use 2.
Before coming to New York, Jesse worked in Vancouver at a legal safe injection facility there. He estimates he has saved hundreds of lives from overdose.
When you look at places like this that are primarily populated by people who use drugs and none of them are dying, I think that should be a pretty good indicator that like something is working. You know, it's like whether you agree with it or disagree with it, you can't argue that.
There haven't been any overdose deaths at the Washington Heights Corner Project bathroom since it started operating in 2005. A sign of success, says Mark Townsend. But now he says it's time for a bigger shift in how we approach the opioid crisis.
Death, it shouldn't be what you get because you're suffering from addiction. It would be like having a mental illness and saying, well, so what if that person dies? So we can do better, and it doesn't need to be like this.
But in the meantime, staff like Lisa and Mark will keep knocking every 3 minutes.
If we don't hear from you, then we're going to be very worried and we're going to come in and hopefully save your life.
For The Takeaway, I'm Alexandra Boti in New York.
I am the stone that the builder refused. I am the visual, the inspiration that made ladies sing the blues.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick, and we want to round out this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday with a look at some of the excitement building around the world of black comics. The 6th annual Black Comic Book Festival drew thousands of people over the weekend in New York City.
I really, really love comics, and I want to also see what was the inspirations of the people. Why did they draw their comic books?
I was intrigued to learn more about black comic heroes, basically.
I'm here to look at books and learn new superheroes.
So we're a big fan of comic books, and I wanted to see it after I saw the Black Panthers coming out in the movie theaters.
I go all the way back to the Superman, Batman, Archie, Richie Rich type thing.
And I'm here like to learn about the culture.
Just a few of the people there who came out over the weekend to the two-day festival. It was filled with panels, illustrators, there was cosplay everywhere. There were longtime fans and newcomers, and a lot of people excited by the upcoming Black Panther movie, others looking for deeper stories in the exploding comics medium. Sheena Howard is Associate Professor of Communication at Rider University and author of the Encyclopedia of Black Comics.
One of the things that black comics in general are doing really well, they're bringing in new consumers and they're tying comics really well to like politics and real life social issues instead of just, you know, the kind of fictional fantasy world of superheroes. They're actually tying in real world issues. So when you take someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates to write Black Panther, he already has his own fan base that's following him because of the political issues in his journalism. And now you match that up with comics and you got a whole world of new consumers and new people interested in comics, which I think is great and which I think we need to see a lot more. And that's really my focus, kind of the political content in comics. That's how I got interested in comics, not necessarily like the superhero kind of fictional stories, but really adding those elements of politics in the comics.
You know, these young movements, Black Lives Matter, protests around Ferguson and Charlottesville in South Carolina, people in the streets, young people in the streets. And I do have a strong sense that also comics are extremely popular among young black kids mm-hmm. right now. I say young black kids, early mm-hmm. 20s, some of the same kids who might be right. out in the streets with protests. How are those two worlds interacting right now?
I think those two worlds honestly have been interacting. When you think about science fiction and people like Octavia Butler who were able to take, you know, science fiction and add that political content. So I think it's been there. I think it's getting a lot more recognition now and a lot more people are getting a chance and a voice through a lot of the online platforms. And a lot of the agency, now that we have to publish our own content, you know, there are graphic novels out now that do deal with police brutality, that do deal with the militarization of the police department, that do deal with these very social issues that we care about. And I like that direction. You know, I got into comics thinking about how the voice that comics had during the civil rights movement and what comics were saying during the civil rights movement. And so I like that direction. I think it's an important direction because I think you can help to change some of the representation or the associations that people make about black people through a medium like comics, the same way you can do with film and television.
Talk about that time a little bit more, because in the 60s there were black comics.
Right.
They were mostly kept out of mainstream media. They were mostly kept out of syndication.
Right.
They were published in black publications, I suppose, black newspapers, but not to a wider audience. But they were still around.
Right. And I think that history is really important when we talk about, you know, the history of segregation and cultural gatekeeping. During that time, black people were absolutely creating comics, mostly comic strips during that time, in the black newspapers like the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier. Brumsick Brandon is one person that was doing really political content during that time and really challenging the status quo in the same way that black preachers were challenging the status quo, in the same way that people were boycotting and protesting. Black comics were also doing their work, too, to protest the things that were happening in the 50s and 60s.
Civil rights icon Congressman John Lewis has taken to the comic, or I call it the graphic novel genre, or the graphic genre. I don't want to call it a comic if that's not what it is. But he's a civil rights icon, and the people around him have decided that a great way to tell his story is through this art form.
Yes, and the graphic novel March is what you're referring to, and it's amazing because those sorts of graphic novels you can bring into the classroom and introduce high school students to those sorts of stories without having them read a history book. They can read this fun and interesting graphic novel and learn about an important person in history and an important person's life in history that they may not have been that interested in just reading it on a black and white page in a classroom as a high school student.
Talk about that a little bit more and the access it provides for young people to get close to an issue they might not pick up themselves. You and I were talking about a minute ago that something as dusty as the 9/11 Commission report was published in graphic form, and a lot of people probably read it because of that.
Right.
The story of John Lewis is not dusty, but then again, a lot of young people might not pick it up unless they have a reason to do so.
Right, and I think that's a great point to make, because now we can think about the possibilities of the numerous stories that we can tell through comics that can suck people in to really learn more about history, but to really engage more with current political issues.
There's been a lot of development and a lot of struggle, a lot of controversy over the last 10 years, I'd say, about the portrayal of women in comics. How does that discussion apply to the portrayal of black women in comics, mainstream?
So I think when you're talking about, you know, the layers of identity, of course, you have to talk about intersectionality. And, you know, if we talk about the representation of women, to talk about the representation of black women adds an additional layer of, you know, well, there are certain stereotypes that black women have to combat, you know, the superwoman sort of stereotype. Black women are independent and these superwomen. The stereotype of the angry black female, the stereotype of what our hair should look like. And so those sorts of things, me as a black female writer, I try to push back on the aesthetics of how black women are being drawn and portrayed, but also try to push back on those stubborn stereotypes that we have of black women and creating characters that kind of buck the trends of those stereotypes. Because from my perspective, it's important as well to use comics and media to challenge the old stereotypes of people of color and women.
Are we getting to the point now, do you think, where young African-American kids can read comics and see themselves or their fantasies, their superhero fantasies, reflected back at them in a meaningful way and not just, you know, an occasional volume or a one-off, but in a consistent way?
Honestly, we've been at the point for at least 10 years where people of color, particularly black people, can see themselves represented. If you're just consuming Marvel and DC, no, we're not being reflected in all of our diversity and glory. But if you're going into a comic book store or you're going to comic book festivals and you're seeing the diversity of people creating comics and all of the different content that's out there, you can probably find a story that closely aligns with your personal experience at this point. I think with the exception of some of the more layered identities like black lesbian female character. You know, there's limited representation of those. Even a black gay male character or an Asian female lesbian character. You know, when we're starting to talk about those complexities, I think it becomes a little bit more difficult. But since there are so many independent artists and writers doing comics, you can find your story out there. And if you're me, somebody like me, you can create your own and write your own story.
Sheena Howard is Associate Professor of Communications at Rider University, attended the Black Comics Festival in New York over the weekend, and most importantly, author of the Encyclopedia of Black Comics. Sheena, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. It was great.
Takeaway producer Dana Roberson attended the Black Comics Festival for us, so thanks to her. That's all for us today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.